Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need. Today, Monday, August the 23rd, Unifor delegates from across Canada will be meeting in Vancouver for convention. This comes 2 months after their president issued a statement calling for urgent Canadian intervention to end the genocide in Palestine, and just weeks after a report revealed Unifor shops were making weapons for Israel. As you can imagine, Palestinian solidarity activists are eager to take advantage of this moment. We've got two of those folks in the studio with us today, both of them organizers with Labor for Palestine, who we have had on the show many times. Their focus this week is on Unifor and the possibilities there, but they're also part of a larger movement to prioritize labor internationalism in the face of rising Canadian nationalism. Be sure to stick around until the end, where both of them explain how and why they remain so optimistic despite the tough political climate we're in and the work that remains ahead. As always, there's a call to action in the show notes. This week, it's a petition to the Canadian Labour Congress, the CLC, demanding they declare Israeli goods hot cargo. Sign it and share it along with the episode. Now let's meet our guests.
Hello, my name is Pamela Arancibia. I'm one of the coordinators for the GTA chapter, so the Toronto chapter of Labour for Palestine.
My name is Shaheen Lotin. I am a member of Unifor Local 2025 as our current president and a member of Labour for Palestine.
Welcome. We're here to talk about hot cargo a little bit, how we can campaign around it, how you already are, and labor internationalism. Now, you folks are going to be busy. The day that we release this, you'll be running around like crazy, I imagine. Unifor's convention is coming up. And funny enough, not funny at all, you know, we had the authors of the arms embargo, now the report that came out that the audience has heard a lot about now. And one of the, you know, bombshells or moments of opportunity was that a lot of the shops, or a few of the shops, I'm here to get more information from you folks, that are making weapons or components that are going to Israel are in fact Unifor shops. So, you know, at first people might be going, oh, how is that possible? Not in union shops, right? So we'll explain where we're at there. But, you know, Rachel, again, she emphasized that this was a good thing that Lana Payne, the president of Unifor, had sent a letter. And so if we team this information up with that letter, this should mean action. How is the campaign going so far? Was this news to you? Let's start there. Was it news to either one of you when we got that report out that Unifor shops were, in fact, Unifor workers were handling hot cargo?
So I guess in short, no, it was not a shock. We have been doing some work internally to sort of map the union to find out where folks are at, in what jurisdiction, what employers they have. And organizations like the Palestinian Youth Movement, World Beyond War, Labor Against the Arms Trade, they've been doing this work for years, especially like before this iteration of the genocide. So we are aware, and we're working on building those maps out more to be able to have those one-on-one conversations with those workers.
It didn't come as a surprise for us. I think one of the things that we've been doing throughout the past couple of years is having pickets or protests at arms manufacturers. And when we do that, obviously we do some research on the background. Some of those workplaces are unionized, some are not. Where they are unionized, we've been trying to talk to workers. Well, in all workplaces, I think we try to speak to the workers and explain to them why we've shown up at their workplace, why we are creating a disruption, and the fact that they also have a role to play. So beyond just the Palestinian issue or what's happening in Palestine, but also with other workplaces or whatnot. So it's something that we have learned about and that people have been tracking and trying to create relationships with those workers in those workplaces just to create potential future organizing.
I understand you making that you're trying to talk to all workplaces, right? Because if it's hot cargo, we want it stopped. But, you know, obviously unionized workers have more mechanisms or maybe bigger asks that you can make of them as opposed to non-protected, non-unionized workers would, you know, they might be with you in the cause, but a tools down for them is like they're all getting fired for sure, right? So the need to focus on unionized workplaces, I think, is what we'd like to hone in on a little bit more here today and like how that gets done. So Shaheen, you talked a little bit more about the mapping. Like, do we have an idea, especially like if we have Unifor on at front of mind here, how many shops Unifor has that are involved that have been flagged in that report or the work that's been done beforehand?
I think if we're talking the Arms Embargo Now report, off the top of my head, I'm not sure if they do name one that is specifically unionized with Unifor, but we do know there's a handful across the country. So again, like, we're doing a lot of work to really find out like where folks are at. Are they in bargaining? When do their agreements expire? Do we have any connections or do we know any contacts in these spaces? So it's really like we need to work from the ground up because we do recognize the basis of a union's power is in the membership. And we want to remind workers that they are uniquely placed. They have expertise. They know their workplace. They can wield power en masse. So we don't want folks to feel like they have to do this on their own. There's a lot of really good work happening. And it's also really sensitive because, I mean, workers are afraid. They're already sort of being hurt by austerity measures writ large. They're also members of their community facing other challenges. And so we know we need to come at this from their perspective and meet folks where they're at. And the impossible task is recognize the urgency of this moment. Like, that isn't even enough to describe how vital this work is. And so things like hot cargo, I guess we also want to like unpack what that means. It's sort of like any good services that's going to or from a state or entity committing war crimes, genocide, human rights abuses, and unions can declare those as hot cargo. So to get to that point, our sort of tack is looking at how can we get to workers and talk to them so that it's worker led to then push the union where we want it to be. We need to bring labor internationalism back. I don't know what has happened, but lately there's the feeling, there is an argument that unions and labor activists have to work on the sort of quote unquote, like, workplace bread and butter issues, wages, benefits, workplace health and safety. 100%, but those also apply to our comrades and workers abroad and in Palestine. There are workers in Palestine. There are postal workers there. There are bus drivers. There are educators, healthcare workers, who all deserve safety and freedom from oppression, not least of which is a genocide right now. So sorry, kind of went on a rampage there.
We like rampages, especially when we're talking about, you know, how to truly show solidarity. Right? Not just Canadian, the Canadian version of it. You asked like, how do we get here? But I mentioned to you before we started recording, the elbows up kind of mentality. Nationalism comes in waves, right? They trigger it in emergencies for capital, right? And I guess we're in one of those. And so we're feeling it a lot. But labor has not been immune to this either, right? Even the auto workers, we did an episode that gave a great example of that divide and how entrenched nationalism, I don't know, some people find a use for it sometimes, but yeah, I imagine it's a difficult atmosphere, even though, like, with this urgency, let's go back to that. Like, it should be obvious to most people watching, especially when you couple what we've already seen with now the starvation, right? The urgency is, but also timing, right? You talked about, when's the collective bargaining agreement? When are conventions, right? So you've got in June, not only, I think it was June-ish, you know,
Unifor sends a letter to Carney.
Yeah.
And, you know, you want to utilize that. But around that same time, I'm not sure chicken, egg, if they're even related. I imagine they are somehow. New Brunswick Federation of Labor passes a resolution at their convention declaring Israeli goods hot cargo. So did one lead to the other? How is that pressure building within Unifor? And then, you know, CLC is not off the hook. We'll get to them, right? Like, but like Unifor, this is the time, right? If they're all going to meet, you can go to all these workplaces, but they're all going to be in like the same place. You're going to have a lot of players there. So now you must feel an extreme sense of urgency because it's Friday, convention's on Monday. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, definitely. This is, we've been talking about this, working on it for months now, sort of waited for that call, the details, where is it going to be, what's the resolution deadline, et cetera, which a lot of union members are doing. It's sort of like, in a funny way, it's almost like an exam. You can cram as much as you can. And at one point you have to sort of like, you've prepared, we're ready. We have the argument, we have, you know, justice on our side. It's building the groundswell of support. So I guess concretely, we do have a delegation going. We're trying to find out who exactly is going to be on the ground. There is going to be a multitude of opportunities to engage with workers. Conventions are intensely political. I think there's going to be around 1,500 to 1,800 delegates. It's massive. There'll be folks from all over the country, some of whom we are in touch with. Some will meet on the ground. And a lot of it is, yeah, those conversations on the ground, talking to folks about what we're doing. And also all of this is really speaking to other workers and where they're at too. So we're not the only one who has a resolution. There's at least a dozen, if not more, going. So we want to talk to them. We want to show our support and solidarity because everyone who is there for workers' rights, workers' protections. And in a Unifor context, yeah, the fact that that letter was sent in June for an arms embargo is huge. It was necessary. It had to happen. And so we want to galvanize that moment to sort of come at it in two fronts, like A, support your union. They're calling for an arms embargo. And B, let's talk about this issue and why it actually matters. Like, we want people to have questions and to ask us to disseminate knowledge and information. This is an issue that not everyone is on X or social media 24/7 reading the news. A lot of us are. And I actually think there are more folks who are on side and supportive. And there's sort of that silent majority that we have to sort of light a fire and get them to take that next step. So it is soon. I was a little bit stressy about it. It's a lot to plan and prepare for. There's a ton of moving parts. But of course, it's not at all just me. I mean, I'm here talking to you today and I'm super happy to, but there's a really strong group of folks who are involved in this. And what I love about labor organizing is I've been chatting with some retired members of Unifor who have great knowledge and insight. They know the union inside and out. They are super supportive. We've got young workers. We've got racialized workers. There's folks who in a normal setting I would probably never come across, but we've come together in unity and for solidarity with Palestine. And those folks who are recognizing, again, this urgency, which is not the right word, but we're in a crisis point and they're recognizing this. And it's really, really wonderful to be able to talk and organize with folks who are on the same page. And so we're coming together. It's a mishmash. I really love, you know, our late Jane McAlevey, who had said to do this work, you have to love people. And you kind of do. And so I think that's the beauty of this. So I'm going in very optimistic and open-minded. And of course, like, the resolution is one thing. It's not the end game. This work, the mobilizing, education, all that still continues. Workshops, discussions about what is hot cargo? How can we implement this? I think the how you had said before is critical. People want to do something. They want to take action, but folks don't know how. So yeah, for anyone going to a union convention, extend your solidarity with us because we'll be on the ground next week or when this is live and hopefully with some good news at the end.
Going back to this piece about, I think you would ask, like, what are some things that workers can be doing? obviously within Unifor, but not only, within every union. I think, you know, when we're, when people tell, ask, they're like, what can I be doing? What should I be doing? I think it's good for workers to sign up to participate in conventions. This is an enormous decision-making body for unions. At not only, of course, at the national or provincial levels or at conventions, but also within their own locals. We are urging workers of conscience to bring resolutions to their fellow members to declare Israeli goods and services hot cargo. I think Shaheen mentioned earlier that we look at hot cargo in the broad sense. So obviously arms and whatnot, but not only, as I said, goods and services, cultural, you know, art, etc., all these things. One of the earliest steps that workers can take, especially in creating a mandate to be able to organize further within their workplaces, within their locals, within their broader union, etc. And also we're encouraging workers who, and obviously these, there's like an escalation and some are easier steps and some you have to build up towards. But for example, workers can negotiate contract language into their collective agreements as well, right? We can try to negotiate hot cargo clauses that would, that workers would be able to say, refuse work or refuse to handle products, goods, services that contribute to genocide, that contribute to apartheid and occupation, to violations of laws at every level, right? National, international, etc. So, and then we see what workers around around the world are doing. So refusing to handle those complicit goods. Obviously, I think building up that language that allows you to be able to refuse goods is important. And that's why we say workers should be negotiating language into their collective agreements. But we also know that sometimes you just, we work as much within the structures as possible. And sometimes we just have to create the circumstances for workers to be able to just defy the regulations and laws when they stand in the way of people of conscience being able to do the right thing. And we're seeing a lot of, I think the most visible kind of workers are logistic workers, right? Working like in, you know, dock workers or whatnot. We see the Greek and Italian workers who have been refusing to handle or refusing cargo or goods to unload in their docks, etc. Those have had to be rerouted. Here in Toronto for Labour for Palestine, I think one of the most visible things that Labour for Palestine has been doing is the arms manufacturer pickets, where we show up just very, very early in the morning before shifts begin to create a disruption and create awareness of what's happening and to delay and to disrupt. I think these are all things that help slow down this war machine, this, you know, the genocide or whatnot. So there are concrete things that workers can be doing. And then, of course, get creative. I mean, we're always seeing people do new sorts of actions or whatnot. But I think within the union structure, we need to understand how to pass resolutions, how to speak to these issues with co-workers, have one-on-one organizing conversations, et cetera. So all the things that we would normally do when we're talking about bread and butter issues and organizing our people, the same thing is what we're encouraging workers to do to make sure that they are not complicit in this genocide and that they are also fighting, actively fighting it.
I think it's far easier to get folks to understand what the right thing is to do, and you can even show them what to do. But let's go back to the climate we're in. We're getting them to prioritize this, you know, from my remembrance of NDP conventions. I was smiling as you were talking because some of the most fun I ever had was trying to cause shit at conventions, you know, and the planning that led up to it. And then it was always an awful experience, though, once it happened, you know, getting shut down at the mic and going up against an establishment that did not want to talk about Palestine. So I'm eager to see how this unfolds. You all seem very optimistic. I've never been at a Unifor convention, so I don't know what you're up against, but sometimes just submitting a resolution and getting it to be prioritized. It doesn't have to be this or that, right? You don't have to give up an increase in minimum wage to fight for Palestine. But sometimes you do, or like, there's so much floor space allotted, right? And so how do you get folks to say, this is the one thing I want to make sure we talk about at convention. This is the one thing I will stick my neck out for. Also in an environment where bosses are not even negotiating hardly, like federal employers are just waiting for Section 107 and they're not negotiating in good faith. So how do you convince workers that like this is in fact worth all the effort and it's just as important to prioritize amongst those other kind of more traditional collective bargaining items you've mentioned, wages and the bread and butter?
I think we've actually been having this discussion quite a bit, especially lately. I think maybe many of your audience members will be familiar with the case of the paramedic from York Region.
Catherine Zyshek.
Yes, in who was terminated for posting something just quite basic, like a simple criticism of what's happening, nothing particularly controversial or anything. And so it, I think it's true. I think folks are sometimes scared to speak, or they don't know if it's like gonna be productive or get anywhere because the conversation does get shut down, or people are reprised against for their activities, etc. But what I would say, especially thinking about Catherine's case, is that I mean, and these are things I said at a press conference, so I'm repeating myself if anybody did see that. But first of all, it's a genocide. Every single person of conscience needs to speak up, regardless, and understand that there are consequences for doing the right thing sometimes, and that silence is just not an option. But in terms of specifically for workers, why should they care about this? This is something we say all the time. Human rights, labor rights, any sort of rights need to be universal. They need to apply to every single person, right? The moment that rights are not universal, it means that they only belong to a select group of people. And all of us should be terrified of that possibility. Rights are not to be, we can't pick and choose who gets them. And so if we're serious when we say that, people should have safe workplaces here, you can't say that Canadians deserve a safe workplace or the ability to work and earn money, but Palestinians don't. It means it's not universal, and it means it's not an actual right. It means it's a privilege depending on where you happen to be born or where you happen to be or what job you happen to be doing. So I think workers need to realize that standing up for the rights of Palestinian workers is also standing up for our rights. A lot of the laws or things that become our, that we take for granted were not necessarily negotiated in Canada. They were negotiated by workers in other countries. And then other workers see what's happening abroad and say, hey, we want that too. We see that with, for example, the elimination of child labor. Things have come out of Canada, the postal workers years ago with parental leave or whatnot. These are gains that then workers in other countries look to and say, we need that too. But also, we can see the erosion of our rights here when we see the erosion of Palestinian rights. Because in order to be able to force us to stay quiet, in order to silence us, it means there have to be repercussions and infringements and violations of our rights. The only way that the Israeli lobby is able to work here and push their agenda is by silencing the vast majority of Canadians are with the Palestinians. And the only way that you can make it so that our voices are not the ones that are being heard and that our politicians aren't hearing us is by silencing us, by criminalizing us, by taking our jobs, by making sure that if people of conscience like Catherine do speak out, that they become, that others become scared because they say, oh, look, this person spoke out. This person has now been fired. Their livelihood has been taken away. How are they paying for their bills? How are they, you know, moving forward? Is she going to be able to get work elsewhere? So it's a culture of fear. And in order for that to be effective, our rights have to be violated. And we see that. And so it is an issue for workers here. So they're not separate issues, and people really need to stop seeing them as separate issues. What affects workers in one part of the world affects workers in every part of the world.
If you were talking about wages, they would understand it quite easily.
Yeah.
Right? When wages are suppressed abroad, their jobs go abroad, right? And so that erosion makes sense when you're talking dollars and cents. And it makes sense to me. Like, you're preaching to the choir. So, but helping them make that connection, you know, should they'll get there. I mean,
any violation of human rights that we accept anywhere in the world is a problem at home, right? If anybody thinks we're already seeing Israeli surveillance being used in our movements here, you know, we're already being affected by what's happening in Palestine. Palestine is the laboratory.
Yes.
And all those tactics, surveillance, violence, restriction of movement, all these things are already coming to us to different degrees or whatnot. And if we continue to allow this, the future for all of us is going to look very dystopian.
They're also testing our limits, right, of toleration. What will we tolerate of them? And right now it's way too fucking much.
Absolutely.
I could go on about NDP convention for quite some time, but I'm not going. But what are some of the obstacles that you encounter? You mentioned delegates and like not truly knowing who's going to show up. That was something that existed in the political sphere as well. Like you tried to contact every local. Who are you sending? Are they friendly? You know, do you have their contact? But you know, you were working, you're not getting paid. Like this is like your spare time kind of deal. And it was such a daunting task. So what are the other obstacles you folks are navigating to build momentum before you go to convention? Cause like major tip, if you wait until convention, like I know you don't, you know this, but for the audience, it's too late, right? Like if you're organizing on Monday, you've lost already. So I imagine, you know, resolutions have to come from locals, be submitted by a certain deadline. And you got to tell people sometimes what those deadlines are, right? Because they're like, what? What's a general meeting? How do I do that?
Totally. So I think we got like the basics down. Resolution was in, we met the deadline. Everything was voted on democratically. Within Unifor, there is a good caucus that has been sort of meeting over the last year plus. So there's a small group of folks who have been talking. I guess in terms of barriers, it's time. If we could do this, you know, every day, 8 hours a day, we might be more ahead of the game. But it's really like in a moment of crisis, building a movement, which is not super easy to do. So we've made those contacts. We're trying to find out. And every organization is always those like key people. We're trying to get in touch. We've done some phone banking to have those conversations. We've leveraged some of these key folks who have been in the union movement for a long time to lend their expertise, to sort of like talk with us and share knowledge. A lot of those folks too have said, you know, they haven't seen this kind of organizing within the union in a long time. And so this is a little bit novel. We did launch a digital action in early August to galvanize more support from already sort of supportive members of Unifor to say like, tell Unifor, you appreciate they've asked for an arms embargo. Now let's take that a bit further. And so the sort of natural extension of a boycott, divestment and sanction resolution or policy or position is the arms embargo and hot cargo. So those are where we need to go. Barriers, it's time, it's conversations, it's recognizing that folks are there for a variety of reasons, including this. And so we're piling this on top of everything else. But as Pamela said, is a genocide, and this needs to be a headline everywhere and at the forefront, and we're doing a disservice by not treating it as such. And so, and we keep building. I think at each time we attend these events, we build those connections and build the contact list. Organizers know that's crucial. We're going to still continue doing things that we have been doing thus far. And there's a lot that kind of just has to happen on the ground, those one-to-one conversations, because we know there's a lot of organizing behind the scenes down to the wire at these things. And so I think we have some support from our L4P comrades who are in Vancouver. Also, IJV, or Independent Voices Vancouver, is helping us out. So we're super grateful to have some folks do the flyering and leafleting on the ground, a sort of classic labor tactic and organizing tactic. So
buttons?
We have, oh, so many buttons. I think I have a bag that weighs about 15 pounds of buttons and stickers.
Need buttons.
Yeah.
It's been a while. I was like, is that not cool anymore? Because like if I came to convention and didn't come home with a Palestine button, I would be very disappointed. Very.
In terms of, yeah, barriers, obviously they exist. We don't choose our members, employers do. And that means we get folks from all backgrounds, all ideas, all political leanings, etc. And obviously, I think the same way that we organize, we know that folks on the other side organize too, whether they're trying to pass resolutions or speak against them. At the same time, you know, I think one of the reasons I'm feeling so optimistic is that we're seeing union after union begin to pass resolutions, something that just a few years ago, sometimes even just getting a resolution to be heard on the floor, that in itself was the struggle. Like, and you know, you didn't even know if you were going to get to a vote. Whereas now I think people understand, there's nobody who doesn't understand that this is happening, and that the conversation is going to come up. And I think just speaking to what Shaheen was saying, all these one-on-one conversations and the phone banking and organizing, these things are working. Like, we are inoculating workers against what they might hear as arguments against, you know, basic human rights. For example, I think a big part of it has been getting folks comfortable going up to mics and speaking and making those, you know, well-articulated arguments, focusing on the issue, not allowing themselves to be sidetracked. I remember just a number of years ago, probably in 2021, 2022, being at a convention. And the moment a Palestine resolution hit the floor, the very first thing you would hear at a con mic was, you know, people need to understand that essentially the argument was, if you were speaking in favor of human rights for Palestinians, in favor of labor rights for Palestinians, etc., you were instantly labeled a Hamas supporter and anti-Semitic. And I think we've inoculated folks enough to realize, no, that's not what we're discussing here. And we won't be distracted by those arguments anymore. We're just not doing it. I think within the labor movement, we all understand that anti-Semitism, like any other form of discrimination, is unacceptable. We will not tolerate it in our workspaces. But we've also inoculated folks to not be scared of just really bad faith accusations of anti-Semitism that have no basis in reality. That has been a barrier, but one that we've been working very hard on. And yeah, Shaheen mentioned IJV is going to be at the convention too. So our comrades there have played an enormous role in getting us to this point where we're able to discuss these things free of bad faith accusations, or, you know, not free of those bad faith accusations. They keep being launched, obviously.
Like, but where are you organizing that no one's calling you anti-Semitic?
Right, but it's just inoculating folks, yeah, and saying, hey, anti-Semitism is a very real thing. We speak against it and act against it when we see it. But also, do not be terrified, because the first thing you hear at one of the mics is like these really shitty accusations of of anti-Semitism. It's nonsense. And I think workers are realizing that, hey, I can have my conscience and that doesn't make me a bad person. It doesn't make me a racist. It doesn't make me anti-Semitic. It doesn't, you know, that having these conversations is important and we can do it and we can do it in a way that respects everybody.
I'm wondering like what that would sound like at the mic this year, you know, trying that old trope for simple resolutions that you're talking about. But also, I'm cringing at the idea of what an opposing resolution might look like. Do you know if there is one? Like, are you expecting one? It's just like, you know, you assume that they're not going to sit this one out. But I mean, like, what would it be? Like, recognize Israeli Independence Day or reaffirm their right to, I don't know. I'm horrified at the idea of what might hit the floor to counter this.
How do I put it? The Zionist, or as Anna Lipman advises us, the Jewish supremacist sort of lobby, the narrative that has been going on for decades to try to crush this. And the more we push back against what imperial powers are deeming that we need to be talking about, hostages left, right, and center, forget about what's happening in Gaza. They're receiving aid. What are you talking about? So that has been manufactured for decades, for generations. And I think a lot of people are aware, as Pamela said, that this is actually not rooted in reality, that there is reality on the ground. We've all seen the assassination of over 280 journalists in Gaza. And we know that they're being targeted because they're telling us what's happening on the ground. Palestinians have been telling us for decades and generations that what they're experiencing day to day is apartheid. It is widely reported that there is wage theft for over 200,000 Palestinian workers. Like, this matters. This is huge. There are workers whose entire livelihoods are oppressed, A, by a colonial empire, which is Israel, and B, by a labor movement that is stealing their wages from them. And so the ability to get liberation from that is deeply rooted in labor internationalism. It's all of us rising up and saying we actually do need to play a role here. And the one funny barrier is recognizing that social justice and human rights are union values. They're already embedded in the union framework. These are not new things that we're sort of saying, hey, we need to talk about this. This is not new. Unifor folks will know the name Bob White. And in 1982, he said this really great quote that I think hits the nail on the head of what we need to focus on today. If the cruise missile was canceled, obviously it would have an effect on employment in both Canada and the United States. But surely in this world that we live in, we ought to find peaceful production that would replace that. So in other words, this is just transition. And as we're saying to workers, like, you have power, you can sort of dictate your future in a collective. We're going to support you. We can't leave folks high and dry. We need to be able to say, like, do we need to manufacture these weapons components? Or could it be for emergency healthcare vehicles somewhere? Are there other ways that we can channel jobs, manufacturing, and industry that doesn't contribute to wars, genocide, and other human rights violations? I think, you know, we all want to free Palestine. We also have to free our own economies from being tied to these industries. We have to start where we are and organize where we're at. And I think this is a lesson in capitalism is essentially a bunch of different components from all over the world that result in, for example, the F-35. It's a lesson in how present day colonization is happening to workers right now. And it has been done with the support and not even complicity, direct direction from states like Canada, the US, and others. And so I think there's a lot we are unpacking in this moment. So I think it's fair if it's going to take time. I don't think anyone imagines that there's a short road to justice. I think there's a lot that we're trying to undo that has been well-funded, well-organized. And so I think union members and workers and folks like who have joined Labor for Palestine are recognizing that, hey, we actually have to stand up to these global forces oppressing all workers everywhere and give them a response so that we're not leaving people out of the conversation.
So we go into Unifor, let's say it's a success. There are some positive resolutions passed. Kind of then what? Because I was doing some digging, reading some articles about labor for Palestine, and I believe it was the maple reminded me of in 2021, there was a resolution passed at the CLC, the Canadian Labor Congress, to oppose the Israeli arms trade. Did that translate into anything that we could talk about, like anything tangible? Because this isn't news to NDPers either, right? It's resolutions can go, they can be very specific, they can be passed almost unanimously, and then nothing, right? They don't get talked about, they don't get prioritized. Is that your experience? What are you going to do?
I think over the years we have seen resolutions that don't really translate into action. So I understand what you're saying, and I think that's a reality that we're all kind of looking at and trying to learn from going forward. I do think even in those cases where perhaps we haven't seen the action we've wanted to, the positive I try and see out of it is that it's created like it's just over the years, it just keeps building momentum. And so today we're at a point where resolutions are passing much more frequently at all sorts of conventions, and they are translating into action. I'll give you the example coming out of the university sector. Many locals over the last few years in academia have been passing BDS mandates in their locals or whatnot. And this has given an opportunity for folks to talk about the issue more and to push it both in academia but also just in the broader labor movement. But where we've seen workers kind of taking their mandates and the resolutions they've passed and putting them into action is, for example, in campaigns to divest pension plans. For example, if you look at the UPP, which is the university, one of the university plans that includes a number of universities, including, for example, the University of Toronto, you have activists who have made that their one of their priorities is divesting from pension plans. So we are starting to see that it's translating into action. Does it always? No. And that I think is on us as workers to hold our unions accountable and to say, hey, you passed us, and now it's time to put the time and the resources into it so that we actually see something coming from it. But I would say if you look at, you know, Palestine solidarity within unions 3 years ago compared to today, it's night and day. And that is a positive thing. Is it fast enough? No. No, obviously, every minute is crucial now. But yes, you know, do our organizations, do our unions sometimes disappoint us and let us down? Yes. Do we sometimes drop the ball as activists? I think in any movement, yes. But I think what you're seeing is people developing their skills, working together, coordinating, and actually building a very real movement that's starting to, that is starting to see like the fruits of that labor. And then I think too is, I guess what I would want to say is that it's really important that no individual union or resolution is going to get us where we want to be. And so I think a broader thing for us to be considering with the labor movement is just what we do when these resolutions don't get passed, or what do we do when these resolutions don't come to to much? And I think we need to all be speaking about escalation. And that's a reality within the frameworks that we're given, but also outside of them. And so we need to be passing resolutions, we need to be pushing for campaigns, education campaigns, action campaigns. But we also need to be preparing workers for work stoppages, for strikes. legal or otherwise, is the reality. This is the point we've gotten to. We do need to be talking about wildcat strikes. We do need to be talking about a general strike for Palestine, but also for all the issues that Palestine is revealing that we have in common: climate change, the arms industry, this neoliberal capitalist system that we live in. I mean, all of these things, you cannot solve any one of these issues just on their own. They're all connected. And so I think we need to be preparing workers to say, look, as much as possible, we want to work within the frameworks that our unions give us, within the legal frameworks that, you know, regulate labor and our ability to do things. But at the same time, a genocide is such an extreme thing that it requires extreme actions from workers too. And if we can't do it through those means, we need to be thinking about taking action into our own hands and saying, we don't care about your laws, we don't care about your rules, we care about stopping this genocide. We're going to do it on our own, right? So it's looking at, you know, that expression, only the people can save the people. Our politicians are not doing that. And so we do need to be building, and I think we need to look to the example of workers like the education workers who did their one day illegal strike in 2022, and now the flight attendants who defied back to work legislation just a few days ago. And we should be inspired, and we should also be looking, again, this is part of that international solidarity, we should be looking to what other countries are doing, because Canadians have very restrictive legislation. We can only strike legally during when our collective agreements expire and while we're in negotiations. But, you know, my family is from Chile, and speaking to family and friends there, workers don't, like, workers go on strike there when they decide that they're going on strike.
How refreshing.
And so we need to be looking at our legislation and trying to change, right? We need to get rid of the legislation that exists. We need to be voting in legislators who are going to actually do something about that. But again, in the absence of better legislation or whatnot, I think we need to just get comfortable with the idea of a movement that engages in civil disobedience, that ignores unjust laws for the sake of a higher cause, and start moving in that direction, and just taking the example of workers who are defiant, you know, here in different sectors, but also internationally. We have a lot to learn. There's a lot more we could be doing.
Absolutely. And it's so important in moments of heightened nationalism to not relent at all, to almost double the efforts, even though we're exhausted, right? It's just like not a time to give that Canada's elbows up crap any space. So I do appreciate you coming on and arming people with arguments to that end as well, no matter where they're organizing. It's a refrain that's used so often, you know, we'll like focus on fixing what's here first, and all these reasons why not to do something. You've given people plenty of reasons on why and how, and that is our favorite part here on Blueprints, right? Because a lot of folks listening, they're sold, they know it, and watching you folks navigate through labor and being so optimistic about where folks are at right now will help us. It will help the mood, and also, you know, just with all the useful tips that you've offered as well.
I think just to like jump onto that, add like a teeny tiny point with education workers and the flight attendants, they gave us a win. And I think anytime workers win, it gives us all a reminder that we can actually build a labor movement that is internationalist in scope, that doesn't accept violence of austerity or the violence of a genocide. Like, it isn't an either or. We can talk about these things in tandem, as workers are part of the community. In the community, there are Palestinians who are our comrades, our neighbors, our friends, folks from all over other countries. Like, this, there's nothing that stops us from workers taking action on the Congo? What are the connections there? How is Canada complicit in Sudan? How is Canada complicit? And these other sort of like global issues that are local in scope. I think that division sometimes falsifies that it's like, not our lane, but in fact it is. It's like right in front of us, and we have to take that seriously.
I think, you keep mentioning, our optimism. And I'm always very influenced by this one quote by Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian politician and was a political prisoner for many years. And he used to speak about pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. And so, yes, we know that we have an uphill battle. We know what the barriers are. And it would be easy to, I think, despair and think like, my goodness, what do we do in this case? But I think we always have to keep that optimism and just keep doing the work, regardless of what the outcome is going to be, because we are people of conscience and it's the right thing to do. And I think for many of us, we're just energized by that, right? That we insist on being optimistic no matter what. And that way we don't give in to despair and we just keep organizing.
I kind of love that. Yeah, I think entry point here is that we don't have the luxury not to be. Like, this isn't a moment that we're gonna, pause or take a break. It's that all of us need to be able to act. And I think it's optimism, or screaming into the void. And I want to choose something that's a bit more productive. And I think start from there. Yeah, I don't think we have the luxury to not be forward thinking. It's so funny just hearing this. I was like, am I that optimistic? I'm always sort of grumbling about this thing here and there, but I think we wouldn't be doing this work if we thought it was going to be, a failure. I think we keep doing it because we know that there are these small wins, and we need to remind folks the what and the how, and educate ourselves, learn from our elders, and sort of continue the work that they've done. So.
I'll link you to an episode. We did do an episode. I've done a whole series on what it's like organizing in the NDP in general, but the conventions were a fucking nightmare. A lot of the prioritizing is done behind the scenes, and you have like no control over it at all. So you can submit anything you want till you're blue in the face, but if it hits the convention floor, you're lucky. And then if they don't try some shenanigans that, eat up literal filibusters on whatever prior to the Palestine, they tried every dirty trick in the book to just like not have it hit the floor. And then, yeah, it was a nightmare. And then one thing that would always be the worst part, I guess, is the resistance from rank and file from your own. You think you're going to this, like, this is NDP, right? You should be NDPers. You are not a conservative, right? You paid to be here. You sat on some local and dealt with all that stuff to be here. And they would still treat you as an agitator. Like, agitators just weren't welcome, like activists weren't welcome. And it was like became like a hostile environment where it was supposed to be collaborative, like that's, I think, the promise. But yeah, so it often a lot of building, but then a lot of burnout would happen. And although we would build numbers and learn skills, all kinds of skills, we really didn't want to go back into those spaces after. It would take a lot of convincing for folks, and that's probably why they're spaced out 3 years or, more sometimes, because it would take you that long to convince yourself to go back in and try to build. But in the end, they're different ends, right? Tools down is completely different than trying to convince voters or donors or, people to work on electoral campaigns. Like, the possible outcomes of a labor convention, I think, are different. So I love hearing like that folks haven't seen organizing like this before, because this is not the first time Unifor's had a convention. So for some folks to say that, there's something to watch. I hope folks will Do they run that live? Like, I know NDP conventions, you can watch on CPAC, or
I don't think so.
how are folks going to know what's happening in there? Because now I need to know, like, as it's happening, I want to know when you're on the floor and someone's yelling at you that you're anti-Semitic. I want, like, I want the play-by-play.
You're gonna have to be on a WhatsApp group with
Oh,
Shaheen.
damn. One of the 8,000 WhatsApp groups.
Just someone add me to, like, I'll be a fly on the wall somewhere, and just like I'll be traveling at the time, but I'll just be like, oh my gosh.
I do think there's some benefit like into like interlocal diplomacy. Like, probably not a bad idea to reach out in advance of Monday to workers in those unions to say, you're going to hear us speaking about this issue. We're not targeting your workers. You know, this isn't directed at our comrades, you know, in certain workplaces. It's, we understand. Like, I always say this, I don't think anybody is a kid and says, I want to grow up to be like a weapons manufacturer. I want to be like creating parts that go toward death, right? But
I hope not.
people fall into these jobs because they pay decently, they're looking for stability, et cetera. And so I think that's always one of the things we say to workers when we're doing, you know, targeted outreach or pickets or whatnot is, we're not here targeting you. We understand that you have bills to pay. We understand that you're just looking for work or whatnot. So it's not that we're putting it on you as workers. We're looking to our government to develop an economy that's peaceful and that contributes to the well-being of everybody. And I think that's a message that we need to make sure that those folks hear, is that this is not against you. We don't want to see you being unemployed. We want a just transition. We want to develop areas where your skills can be put to, you know, to positive ends rather than death.
And like, workers aren't signing the contracts. Yes. Workers, the ones we're talking to, they're not the ones signing the contracts for these things. It's their employers that are doing it. And I think one thing, the first week, I think I mentioned this action, there's about 50 locals that had signed on just like kind of off the bat. And so I think that number has grown. We are talking to different locals. There's a ton of folks who are sort of like supportive of their own volition, and yeah, we want to remind them that like their voice really does matter. We want them in this conversation. No one wants to feel, we don't want it to be like we're forcing this upon you, but we want people to come in willingly and see the severity of this moment. And we understand that in rough times and when it's hard to find a job, having a unionized position is obviously huge, and we want all workers to be able to have those protections. And then, yeah, just kind of reminding them that we live in the world. Our borders are porous, and we want them to be able to see themselves in this work too. But y'all are making me more nervous. I'm hoping that there's some good news I can share, or news of an escalation. We'll see how it's gonna go.
No, I lean on. I can't remember which one of you said it, but it was like no one resolution anyway is going to get us there. It's the building and the skills and the connections that you make doing that work, right? Because quite often we have to not fail, but like not succeed in those mechanisms we know weren't really built for that stuff to thrive in anyway, right? It's just like hearing you both have the will and are building the will to just defy these systems is probably more critical than anything else, really. There'll be a million resolutions down the road to pass, but that defiance stays. It's kind of a one, it applies to all, hopefully. Unpaid work and genocide, hopefully.
It's true.
I want to thank both of you and your comrades that, couldn't join us. We can't fit everybody in the studio, but we will link people back to Labor for Palestine for sure, and find ways to get involved in the Hot Cargo campaign, as well as the report we keep referencing. I think I've linked that to like six episodes in a row now, because it's providing so many different points of pressure for people to lean on. The air show will be the next one you hear
Yay.
following this one here. So thank you very much for also taking the time to explain all of this to our audience. I do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having us, Jessa.
The pleasure's mine, folks.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content. And if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.